Hello, and welcome back to ACRACT. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have a fabulous show for you today. We are going to do an update and further exploration of a topic that we delved into a few years ago, and that is dental anesthesia. And I have with me Dr. Connor Schmenk. Connor is a board-certified dentist anesthesiologist. He's adjunct faculty at the Ohio State University College of Dentistry and the owner of his own mobile dental anesthesiology practice, where he travels to provide general anesthesia and sedation for patients of dentists and dental specialists within the dental office. So we're going to expand on the conversation that I had with Jay Grimes a few years ago and talk about some new stuff. So I think this will be great. It's really interesting, especially for those not only who are dental anesthesiologists, but also for people who are anesthesiologists doing NORA cases, because I think there's a lot of overlap. So I'm really excited to have Connor with me. Connor, welcome to the show.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much, Jed, for having me. I appreciate it. I travel a lot for my work, so I listen to a lot of podcasts, and yours is one of my frequent ones. As I say in radio, longtime listener, first-time caller, so I'm excited to be here. Before we get too started, I believe Friday the 20th, that was your guys' match day. Is that correct?
That is correct. We are recording this on the 24th, so just 4 days after match day.
Awesome. Congratulations to everybody that matched. That's very exciting. And I'm excited for everybody to get started in anesthesia. That's fantastic. And wishing everyone the best.
Yeah, totally agree. We couldn't be happier with our incredible folks we matched. And I hope that's true for everyone across the country, and especially for folks who matched. I hope you're happy with your match. And I guess since we're talking about it, I'll just say, if anybody's listening who didn't match, hang in there. It's not the end of the world. There are other opportunities, whether that's reapplying in anesthesiology or thinking about a different career. But the world is so full of opportunities, and you don't always realize it in the midst of a disappointment. I just did, Connor, you'll appreciate this because I know you have little kids. I just did parent reader for my 8-year-old's class. Like, literally, I was just there an hour ago. And one of the books I read them was Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss. And one of the things I love about that book, in fact, my parents gave me that book when I graduated college. Not that I had never read it before, but they gave it as a college graduation gift because it's so meaningful. And one of the things it talks about is, you know, oh, you're going to do all these great things, but also you're going to fail. You're going to have setbacks. You're going to have difficult times. And all of that is part of the journey. So hang in there. If this is one of those difficult times for you, you'll get through it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about dental anesthesiology. So give us a little quick recap of the path of training and training requirements for those pursuing this field.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know that you guys had the fantastic episode, episode 243 with Jay Grimes. You guys did an excellent job in covering everything about our field. But just a quick recap for anybody that has not listened to the episode, I suggest you guys go back and listen to it. It is great. But anybody who hasn't listened to it in a while and kind of forgot or has not listened to it yet, for people thinking, you know, when in the world did dentists become dentist anesthesiologists and start doing anesthesia? Who had the bright idea that you guys should start doing that? Well, it's from the very beginning, right? So back in the mid-1800s, two very famous dentists and famous people in anesthesiology, Horace Wells and William T.G. Morton, were part of the founders of anesthesiology. And for the longest time, 100 years, dentists and physicians worked hand in hand. We were discovering anesthesiology, working towards keeping people safe and asleep and comfortable. And it really wasn't until around the 1950s that you really had that split where physicians, with the rise of the ASA and just the rise in the amount of physicians going into anesthesiology and kind of the decline of dentists going into it, you start to see that split where they're not so much hand in hand anymore. It starts to be more and more physician-led field. But at the time, dentists still continued practicing anesthesiology, doing anesthesia residencies. Really, it was physician residencies that dentists were taking parts in. So physician residencies were taking dentists, a couple of dentists per year, and allowing them to work with the physicians and learn alongside physicians, for the longest time. Really, it wasn't until the 1970s. I don't know what the case is for medicine, but in dentistry, there's this concept where a general dentist, when they graduate dental school, when they're licensed by the state, they can pretty much do any procedures within the field of dentistry that their license can cover. So anything that a specialist can do, so an oral surgeon doing wisdom teeth, an endodontist doing root canals, a periodontist doing gum graft surgeries, that's not just specific to the specialties. That's any dentist can do that if they're so trained and feel that they can do that. They're just held to the standard of the specialist. Is that the case in medicine as well? I wasn't sure.
Yeah. Okay, so perfect. When you get a medical license, so you have to, in order to get a medical license, you have to do at least 1 year of residency. So you graduate medical school, you do an intern year and anything, you can get a medical license. And in theory, you could hang up a shingle and do neurosurgery in your garage, right? I mean, you can do anything. Now, a hospital is not going to necessarily give you privileges to do it. But if you, but for you guys, right, if you had your own office, you could offer any procedures you want and, you know, be licensed to do them. Obviously, you know, you're not going to be able to do some of them in your own house. But in theory, yes, that's the same.
Yep, exactly. So same thing in dentistry. So if a general dentist wanted to go try to perform a Lafore osteotomy, they'd be insane to do so, but their license says they can do it. The exception to this is anesthesia. So in the 1970s, there were a couple high-profile deaths from a dentist actually in Columbus, Ohio, so right down the road from me, where it really kind of sparked, hey, you know, maybe – not everyone should be able to do this. Not every dentist should be able to do anesthesia. So this is where a lot of the laws were first established, the state laws from the state of Ohio saying, hey, if you want to, if you're a dentist and you want to do a general anesthesia, you have to have done a residency in either in anesthesia or oral maxillofacial surgeons as well, learn how to do anesthesia. So their residency as well. But starting in the 1970s, it's no longer the case where dentists can just say, hey, I feel good, I can do anesthesia. That's not the case anymore. So that's really where it really started becoming restrictive from dentists as well, for good reason.
And Connor, let me just ask you, when we say that, are we talking about general anesthesia? Like, where's the cutoff? Could a dentist who doesn't have any additional training, you know, give a Ativan pill to their patient? Like, what's the cutoff of where you can no longer do it?
Yeah. So, any dentist can prescribe oral medications for mild sedation. So like doing a Halcyon tablet before they come into the office. But assuming they have the right licenses for that, you know, DEA license, that kind of stuff. When you start getting into some moderate sedation, there are moderate sedation permits that a dentist must acquire. They have to do continuing education for that. I believe, in the state of Ohio, it's 60 hours of continuing education. And there are specific requirements for that. It's on a state by state basis. And you can look up your own state's requirements for that if you're so inclined. But moderate sedation is where you need to start being licensed by the state to do it. General anesthesia, there's no, so when I say I'm a dentist anesthesiologist, it's not that I took CE courses. I did a full 3-year residency. So if you want to do general anesthesia, you have to have done a full residency, through an accredited program now. So after the 1970s, it was, dentists still training with physicians that they were doing physician residencies still to be able to get these permits. It was in the 1990s that the ACGME came out with a memorandum basically saying no ACGME physician program can take dentists anymore. And this is where you start to see the rise of our dental anesthesiology residencies. So we were admitted by ADA's Commission on Dental Accreditation in 2005 to become fully accredited programs. We now have 9 fully accredited 3-year programs within the United States and 1 in Canada. There are, I believe, through my quick math and Googling, 32 spots per year. So there's not many of us. But every program is fully accredited. It is must be sponsored or co-sponsored by a U.S.-based hospital, and it falls underneath the Department of Education. So, and we are now a recognized specialty as well as of 2019. So, going through all the hoops, and we do full residencies of our own now. Just kind of a quick look into, you know, what our residencies are like. I know you guys talked about this with Jay a lot, so I won't cover it too much. But for our residencies, 24 of the 36 months that we do must be devoted to the clinical practice of anesthesia. And 12 of those months must be in a hospital anesthesia service that provides trauma or emergency care. And those services are under the direction of a full anesthesiologist full-time, multiple. I practiced at Ohio State, or I did my residency at Ohio State. So the makeup of the program, it's going to be program dependent on the full makeup of the program. The way it worked at Ohio State was that when the physicians came in, the CA1s came in and did their orientation. Me and my one other dental resident first year were thrown in, and the expectation was that we're just like, you know, we had the same expectations as the physicians. We learned alongside them, went to their lectures. For the first 6 months, I might as well have not even been in a dental anesthesiology program, because I didn't even, you know, I talked to my program director once a week, but other than that, I wasn't in it at all. I was in the hospital. Once we get past the first year, you kind of start to separate besides those 12 months in the hospital. You also do rotations in cardiology, emergency medicine, intensive care, pain medicine, pediatrics, pre-op clinic, all that kind of fun stuff. And where the training kind of tends to differ from physicians is we do a lot more, obviously we do cases at the dental school and with purely dental cases, non-operating room stuff in residency to prepare us for working in dental offices. And then at Ohio State, at least and this is going to be program dependent as well. Some of the subspecialty stuff I didn't do that the physicians were doing. So things like cardiothoracic surgeries, you know, because of case numbers and stuff, they didn't really want to give away cases to us for that. So, you know, I didn't really do that so much. I didn't do OB at Ohio State. I don't know about you, Jed, but not many dental offices need epidurals placed that when I go. So I don't feel as though I'm missing out at all by not being able to place an epidural. And then we did more pediatrics because just the nature of dentistry, the people who are going to need anesthesia for dentistry, a lot of it's going to be kids. So I did 6 months at Nationwide Children's Hospital, just pure pediatrics, doing all sorts of cases there. And then I did another additional 2 months at a surgery center, which was just pediatric dentistry. So I did 8 months of pediatrics solely devoted just anesthesia day in, day out of pediatrics. And then other than that, you know, we have required case numbers just like you guys do, all that kind of fun stuff. But that's kind of where the training stands, and that's kind of how we get to where we are now. So once you graduate, the one more difference that I kind of wanted to talk about with between dental anesthesia and the physicians is that we do have some specific state laws that we're beholden to as well. As far as I understand it, when a physician comes out, if you guys wanted to practice in a dental office, you just come in, you say you're practicing anesthesia there, and you're just good to go. I have to apply for permits through the state, like we talked about. I have to prove that I did a residency. And then I have a state inspection, at the dental office to make sure that, my setup is good and I have everything I need and everyone's trained the way they need to be trained. And I have emergency procedures and all that kind of fun stuff. And then in addition to that, we must do, at least in the state of Ohio, I have to prove I did quarterly emergency drills as well. So there's just some different state requirements that you guys might not have that we do have that might differ, as well between, the dental anesthesiologist and the anesthesiologist.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. So let's talk about why general anesthesia would be needed for dentistry. I think everyone understands why some sedation may be needed, but what are the scenarios where you need general anesthesia?
Yeah. So that's a great question. You know, I've definitely run into cases where people are kind of like, you know, it's just dentistry, like, you know, do some local and do the tooth. You know, we adults get local done for dentistry all the time and we're just fine. So why would you need to put somebody fully asleep for it? I wish that was the case, but unfortunately, there are times when it is definitely needed. It's not purely elective. It is something that actually needs to be done. So the most common one that we just talked about is going to be pediatrics, right? So, there are some kids, and it doesn't mean that they're bad kids. It doesn't mean that, you know, there's anything wrong with them. It's just, they're kids, you know? And, if they have a lot of dental work that needs to be done, sometimes they're just not going to be able to sit through that. And a lot of times, you know, I'll get kids who they were so good for one appointment and they were able to get one quadrant done. And then the next appointment, they knew what was coming and it just wasn't going to happen. So unfortunately, kids do need general anesthesia for dentistry. Before general anesthesia became common for dentistry for kids, what was common to use was something called a papoose board. And basically what it is, it's like a straight jacket attached to a board where they just strap the kid's arms down and the parents and the staff and the dentist hold the kid down, kicking and screaming, and they just start drilling. And as you can imagine, that's not safe or fun for anybody involved. It's not fun. I've never witnessed one, thankfully. But I can't imagine it's very fun. So it can cause a lot of PTSD and trauma and anxiety and distrust of dental work and going to the dental office in the future for these kids, understandably. So we don't like to do that. It's not really, it's not something we want to be doing. General anesthesia is actually the better alternative to that. What's the impact of untreated dental disease on childhood development? Because, you know, the alternative to that is just, hey, let's wait until they're a little older and let's just do it when they're older. They're just baby teeth. They'll fall out. Who cares? You know, well, dental infections can get pretty bad. And just leaving the tooth in the mouth isn't always the answer. So these kids, there's a lot of kids, and I've seen it and heard it a lot. People who can't get in to get general anesthesia to have their kids' dental work done. These kids have chronic infections. They're in pain. They're not sleeping. They have to go to the hospital. These parents are bringing them to the ER so that they can get antibiotics and pain medicine. They have poor eating habits. They can get some nutritional deficiencies. They have trouble in school because they're not sleeping well. They're not eating well. There's a social impact with their peers because their teeth are you know, don't look good. So it's just an overall reduced, you know, quality of life that kind of is something that I wouldn't wish on anybody. If you haven't experienced it, it's really a shame that it happens. So we need to do it. You know, there are just times where we have to put the kids to sleep and we have to get the dental work done to bite it in the butt. Okay. And I don't know if you've listened to the news a lot, but there's been a lot of distrust recently with fluoride and doctors and dentists in general. So the prevalence of early childhood caries is not getting better. A study from 2013 to 2018 showed 10.6% of all children have severe dental disease, have early childhood caries. And this has only gotten worse just anecdotally with the pandemic and the anti-fluoride movement. So it's a problem that's getting worse. There's an increased need for anesthesia for pediatric dentistry.
What fluoride does for kids, mm-hmm, yeah. I think, tell me, is it strengthens the teeth, and I'm guessing then they're more resistant to getting caries. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially what happens, your tooth is a structure of a substance called a hydroxyapatite. And what happens is that just like any crystalline substance, it can dissolve, right? If you get an acidic environment, whether it's because you're drinking Mountain Dew or because you have plaque on your teeth with acidophile bacteria that produce acid and lower the pH of the environment, what happens is the tooth just starts to dissolve and your enamel starts to wear away. And then once you reach the enamel is the thin layer of stronger material around what the inner layer called the dentin, which is a little softer and dissolves at a little bit of a higher rate and a higher pH. And once it gets underneath that enamel, it just spreads, you know, the cavity, the bacteria, everything spreads. So it reaches the tooth and causes an infection, which it reaches the blood supply and the nerve in the middle of the tooth called the pulp. So what fluoride actually does is it integrates into the hydroxyapatite and creates fluorohydroxyapatite. And what that does is it lowers the solubility constant of the tooth and the pKa of the tooth, so that it dissolves at lower pHs. And it dissolves at a slower rate. It can actually remineralize areas that have been demineralized and softened. So that's how it works to prevent tooth decay, and people should use it.
Adults and kids, everybody, it'll help anybody, including adults, keep their teeth in better shape.
Absolutely. Everybody needs fluoride. It's naturally found in groundwater. And it's it's good. So I highly encourage people to use fluoride.
Great. Okay. So because of the, is it maybe the anti-fluoride movement, but just in general, I'm sure all the sugary drinks, everything has contributed to higher rates, significant rates of childhood dental disease. And so kids need to get this taken care of. As you said, if they don't get it taken care of, there are a ton of negative effects on their development.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I do want to say, too, just to avoid the stigma of it, just because a child has early childhood caries is not an indictment on the parents at all. And it doesn't mean that they're anti-fluoride, and it doesn't mean that they did anything wrong. Believe it or not, one of the biggest – so when we see really young kids, the kids like the age of two who have really bad caries and or cavities, one of the biggest things that can lead to that is called baby bottle caries, or essentially when children drink milk or nursing overnight to help them sleep. I have young kids. I can tell you right now, there is a lot in life I'd do to make my kids sleep. And the hospital doesn't tell you when you leave, hey, don't – when your child starts getting teeth, don't keep giving him milk overnight. Nobody says that to you, right? And a lot of parents don't bring their kids into the dentist when they're that little because they don't have teeth yet. So no dentist is telling him that either. So these parents come in and they're like, why does my kid have all these cavities? You know, I didn't do anything. And it's like, well, do they need milk to go to sleep at night? And it's like, okay, yeah. There you go. That's what it is. So don't do that once your child has teeth. And it doesn't mean that – and even older kids, you know – people just don't know sometimes, and that's okay. It's a stigma. It's not always the parents' fault. Sometimes it just happens.
Great.
But anyway,
so yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Moving on from pediatrics, some more people that might need anesthesia for dentistry. A big one's going to be special needs, right? So special needs patients, for obvious reasons, just like pediatrics, they're going to be, not cooperative. And it's an even bigger problem for them almost, because for kids, there are sometimes when you know, if they only need one thing done, sometimes you can kind of coax them through it and get them through it without needing the general anesthesia. There are some special needs people who just, it's just not going to happen. And there's a lot of pediatric dentists, out there. Not as many people seeing special needs, you know, and not a lot of dentists like seeing special needs. Not a lot of them do it. And a lot of people go a long time without getting the dental care that they need, when they're special needs. So that's a big one. I actually, one of the offices that I've worked at, they do see special needs, and, a lot of them are driving hours, you know, hours away to see somebody because it's hard to get access to care for them. So that's going to be another group of people that need it. And then finally, you know, just for normal adults getting stuff done, if they have dental phobias, there are people who have had traumatic experiences in the past and they just, you know, the sound of a dental drill just sets them off, you know, people like that. Or, you know, some people who might be okay, but you might have some of these longer procedures. Maybe it's something that's a little more uncomfortable, like a surgical extraction, or there's going to be a lot of cracking of bone and a lot of whirring of the dental drill and a lot of pressure. And it, you know, somebody might say, hey, I can, you know, I could get through this if it was a half hour long, but this is going to be a 2 hour thing. Like I just can't. So that's kind of the people that tend to need the general anesthetic for the dental work.
Great. You know, every once in a while we do anesthesia for dental work in the hospital. That tends to be people with like significant comorbidities. Maybe they have, you know, congenital cardiac disease or something where they really need to be in a hospital setting. But for the most part, I think a lot of this is done in the dental office. And why is that? Why is it better to do in the dental office rather than like at a ambulatory care center or a hospital?
Yeah. So, I would hesitate to say it's better to be done in the dental office. You know, general anesthetic, is better to be done in the dental office, but there are times when it's certainly feasible and certainly makes sense to do it in the dental office. So we can kind of approach this from kind of three different ways to think about it is, you know, why, first off, why would a patient want to be done in a dental office or have their child or their whoever be done in the dental office? Why would the dentist rather do this in the dental office than at the hospital? And then why would, you know, me as an anesthetic provider want to work in a dental office to begin with? So for patients, you know, first and foremost, the biggest reason is going to be access to care. It's always going to come back to access to care. Wait lists for hospitals, for pediatric dentistry or for special needs dentistry it's inadequate. The overtime that they get is inadequate. It's been inadequate for a really long time. It's only gotten worse. The American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry did a whole report on denial of access to care of ORs within hospitals. In 2021, 2/3 of all states reported worsening denial of access of care to OR time. And 2/3 of those 2/3 reported it as moderate to severe. So they're having a really hard time getting into hospitals. Just anecdotally, I have talked to some pediatric dentists who, you know, it can be up to a year out. When you have a child who has an infection, who has, you know, they're on antibiotics, they're waking up at night, they're not eating well, and they're just miserable. And you tell that parent it's going to be a year. That's not okay. And it's just not something that we ever want to happen for anybody in our community. So that's a big problem and a reason why it could be done in the dental office because it's even worse for special needs too. Access to care for special needs is atrocious. I would say, so just anecdotally as well, I work at Ohio State and the Ohio State GPR, I overheard a resident the other day say that the wait list is getting up to 2 years at this point. Wow. To get in the hospitals. That's insane. And at that office I talked to when they have to go to the hospital. So the office I work at where they see special needs, the dentist, he did a residency, a hospital based general practice residency. And so he got OR time at the hospital to see special needs. And then a couple of years ago, the hospital was redone. They had a bunch of ORs added and changed things up and they kicked him out. And now he doesn't get hospital time, which is why he contacted me. Because it's, hey, I have patients. If I don't see them, then they're going to have to travel 4 to 5 hours, take off work, get hotel rooms to do this. And the waiting list is 2 years too, you know? So it's just, it's a problem that has only gotten worse. So that's a big motivation for doing it in the dental office. And then the other reason is going to be cost, right? So typically things like this would be covered by medical insurance, right? Going to a hospital and having anesthesia done. Unfortunately, insurances have this thing called determination of medical necessity. And something that should be a slam dunk, hey, this child has infection and they need to go in to go undergo general anesthesia to get it taken out. They should be covered. The insurance companies don't always say that. Sometimes they come back and they say, hey, we don't think that this should be covered, so we're not going to cover it. And OR time in the hospitals, if you're paying out of pocket, is ridiculously expensive. One of my colleagues was recently telling me a story about somebody who came to them because they were scheduled to go to the hospital. Their insurance said they weren't going to cover it. And they were going to have to sell their house if they wanted to get it done. So it's, you know, it's cost prohibitive. It's just not feasible for a lot of people. And even if you have medical insurance, a lot of people with high deductible plans, you know, it's still going to cost, it can cost, you know, $6,000-$7,000 to get this done. And hospital bills will run up that high. So you're going to hit your whole deductible, right? So, yeah. That's a big reason why people may choose to do it in the dental office because it's going to be more affordable and it's going to be more doable for a lot of people. Now going towards the dentist, you know, so the reason they might want to have this done in the dental office as opposed to in the hospital is that they have all of their tools there. They have everything they need. A lot of hospitals will stock some things, but they're not going to have, you know, the specific tools that they like or the composite that they like or the some of the materials that they might use on a regular basis. So it's just unfamiliar. And then some places, you know, I've heard of pediatric dentists that said that there was one place that they worked at that didn't even have stuff for x-rays. So they were having to, you know, hold these kids down and just try to get the best x-rays they possibly can with an unoperative kid. But a lot of times they're not turning out very well. So you're kind of doing dentistry flying half blind, which isn't really, you know, something you should never want to do. So the dentist is going to be inclined to do it in their office if they can. And then for me, the anesthesia provider, you know, why would I want to do this in the dental office and not work in a hospital? So Jed, one of the reasons I really like your podcast and I appreciate what you do is that you talk a lot about, physician well-being, about, burnout and things that contribute to that. And I actually did a master's thesis when I was in residency and mine was over, burnout in residency for dental anesthesiology residents. And so I did a lot of research into, a lot of the physician, papers talking about what causes burnout in residents and in anesthesiologists specifically. So a lot of the risk factors for having a high risk of burnout, things like having a lack of control within the workplace, getting an add-on at the end of the day and feeling like you have no say in when you go home, you know, long work hours, taking a high frequency of overnight calls. I don't take call. I have not had the word add-on in my vocabulary for 3 years now. I don't get add-ons. If the dental assistant comes in and say, hey, op seven, they got a wild one over there. You got to put them to sleep. Did they eat today? It's 3 p.m. Sorry, I can't do it. You know? So I'm not changing my dinner plans. You know, I know when I'm going to get out. Days obviously run long sometimes because things come up, but for the most part, I have a lot more control over my workday, being my own boss and setting my own hours and setting up my work environment the way I want it. So work-life balance is a big reason that people do it. I don't take call. I don't work weekends. I set my own days. I don't have to ask to take off. You know, if I want to go on vacation, I just say, hey, I'm not going to be working this day. I have to give a lot of heads up to make sure they don't schedule anybody at the office, but I have control over all of that. Obviously, owning your own business and all that has its own stressors that contribute to burnout, but it's different. And some people may find it appealing.
Yeah, certainly a lot of that sounds appealing.
Yeah. So in addition to that, I choose who I work with. I work with a lot of great, fantastic people, fantastic staffs. I see the same people day in and day out. I work very closely with them. And it's great to be able to work with the same people all the time, go into the same offices all the time, not be bounced around a lot, and get to choose, you know, who I work with from that standpoint. And then, like I said, just being your own boss is its own reward, you know, to be able to make decisions and feel like you have control over the decisions that are made is fantastic.
Great. Well, let's talk about some of the procedures that are done. I would imagine that there are a lot of differences between a general dentist office, an oral surgeon's office, a periodontist office. So what can people expect they would see based on what kind of provider they're working with?
Yeah, absolutely. So for people who don't really know the differences between all of that, so let's start with oral maxillofacial surgeons, the people that people most typically think about when they think about general anesthesia for dental procedures. It's going to be oral maxillofacial surgeries. They do a 4 to 6 year residency. Some of them actually do a 6 year residency and get their MD on top of the DDS. And then they're doing, you know, the big surgeries that you think about, the Lafort osteotomies. They're doing the big biopsies and resections, orthognathic surgeries, cosmetics, emergency fractures, stuff like that. That's going to be your oral surgeons. Now, in a dental office, if I'm traveling to an oral surgeon's office to work, obviously I'm not going to be doing big, you know, resections or doing Lafort osteotomies. I mean, I guess you could, but typically not going to be doing that out in the office. So typically what anesthesiologists would get called into an oral surgeon's office for, it could be for something where, because a lot of them do their own general anesthesia. They are licensed to do that for things like typical third molars, implants, stuff like that. But there are times when they want to have their hands free. They want to focus on the surgery and they want to make sure it's going to be a longer case. They don't want to be fiddling with stuff and they don't want to have to focus on two things at once. They may call in an anesthesiologist to come and do, like, let's say they're doing a big implant case that's going to take a couple hours or some sort of surgery like that. That's typically when they're going to be calling somebody in. Or some of them, a lot of times, will call in for kids. They may not want to be doing kids, and so they may call in an anesthesiologist. The other big one, pediatric dentists, they focus on kids, and they do a lot of special needs as well. So their typical procedures that they're going to call you in for in office is going to be just typical normal stuff on kids' teeth, like crowns, extractions, fillings, stuff like that. Little tidbit I wanted to include here. It's kind of funny because whenever kids come in, you always think, man, I'd hope that's just fillings and not a lot of other stuff. It goes in the inverse. So fillings take a lot longer than crowns on kids, and crowns take a lot longer than extractions do on kids. So if I see a big case that has a lot of fillings, kind of hoping that they turn into crowns, because that's going to make my case in the day go a lot faster if they turn into crowns, and crowns turning into extractions, obviously worse for the kid, but it makes things move faster. And so typically if kids have a lot of the little work to be done, that's going to be the bigger or longer cases. If a kid has a lot of fillings that needs done, that's going to be a long case. A kid who just needs some extractions done, it's going to go pretty quick. They do a 2-year residency. They do a 1-month anesthesia rotation where they go into the ORs and shadow and you know, do some hands-off stuff with anesthesia. So a lot of them are going to be, and they do cases in the hospital, so they're going to be pretty familiar with anesthesia, with doing cases under anesthesia. So if you're working with a pediatric dentist, you can be fairly certain that they know what they're doing when it comes to doing cases under anesthesia. So you mentioned periodontists. A lot of people might not know what periodontists do. They focus on the supporting structures of the teeth. So things like the bone, the gums, the periodontal ligament. A lot of what they do is going to be gum grafts, bone grafts, and then they're big on implants. They do a lot of implants. So if the typical procedures you're probably going to be called in for a periodontist is going to be things like big implant surgeries. They do a 3-year residency, and they're trained in IV sedation. So a lot of them will be familiar with doing cases for people who are sedated. So we'll have more experience with people who are not fully awake. You know, you have your endodontists as well, which is going to be less common to be called in for because those are root canals, and typically people aren't getting called in for root canals unless it's a child is the one that you might get called in for root canals at an endodontist office. And they're not going to be as familiar with doing things under general anesthesia. So that's something you have to take into account if you go there. And then finally, we get to our, you know, the general dentist. So dentists can do something called a GPR residency, a general practice residency. And these are hospital-based dentistry programs that focus on special needs and doing dentistry within the hospital. And a lot of them learn all types of procedures and IV sedation. So they'll be familiar with IV sedation, but they also do cases in the hospital for some special needs patients. So they are going to be familiar with doing cases under general anesthesia. They're going to know how to place a throat pack. They're going to know what you're doing, they will do a 1-month anesthesia rotation as well. So they'll have more idea of what you're doing. And then when you get down to the general dentist, these are people come straight out of dental school. So a lot of them might not have a whole lot of anesthesia or sedation experience. And that's something to take into account if you're going to work with them. You just might have to know that they're not going to know what you're talking about all the time. And you might have to be a little extra prepared and make sure that you take the time to make sure that everybody understands what's going on before going to one of their offices.
All right. What is this thing called all on X surgery? It is something that seems to be getting more popular. And does it require general anesthesia?
Yeah. So there has been a big explosion of not just dentists, anesthesiologists working in dental offices, but physicians are starting to work in dental offices more as well now because of this big thing called all on X surgeries, and everybody and their mother wants an anesthesiologist to come in to do their all on X surgeries for them. It's really big right now. And essentially what it is so when you think about a classic patient with a full denture, the secret about dentures, your typical plastic denture that goes in and comes out when you go to sleep, and it falls out when you're talking. And the secret about dentures is that everybody hates their denture. Dentures are terrible. No, it's nobody is ever happy with their denture. Dentists are continuously underselling how their dentures are going to do because patients hate them. So a while ago, people had this genius idea, which is, hey, we know how to place dental implants and we know how to put single teeth on dental implants. So why don't we take a bunch of dental implants, you know, take all the teeth out, put in a bunch of dental implants, and just attached the denture to the implants. So now what you have is called a hybrid denture or an all-on-4 denture or all-on-6, or that's why it's all-on-X, is just how many all-on-how-many implants that this denture is going to be sitting on. So typically how dentists do this is what they'll do is a lot of these patients, they have to have good bone. Another secret to dentures is that the longer you have dentures, once the teeth come out of the mouth, the bone starts to resorb. You get less and less bone height within your mouth the longer you go without having teeth, and which makes your dentures worse, and people hate that. So you need somebody with good bone height. So what you're typically going to have to start with is they need to have their teeth still. So they're going to start with an extraction of all of their teeth. And then you're going to do a big flap and you're going to open everything up. And then you need to make space, because you need space not only for the implants, but the metal base that the denture is going to sit on. And then for the denture, the plastic gums that are going to show, and then the teeth of the denture as well. So that's a lot of space that you need within the mouth. And you want the patient to, their bite to be normal when you're done, that you don't want their mouth to be sitting wide open when they're done, because the teeth don't fit. So you got to take down the bone. So you're going to do alveoloplasty, and they're going to take a pineapple burr and they're just going to shave down bone. So you're going to extract the teeth. You're going to flap open the gums. You're going to shave down the bone, and then you're going to place implants. And then you're going to suture everything back up. You're going to do impressions, and then you're going to create the dentures, and then you're going to screw the dentures on. A lot of systems have been developed that have made this a lot easier and a lot streamlined for people. So all these companies are selling these systems now where, they have specialized prosthetics that you kind of put into the mouth, and it's like a guide for everything. So it guides you how to do it. As you can imagine, a lot more people have started doing them. And as you can imagine, this can take a while. That's a lot to do on a patient. So it's a lot for patients to go through when they get it done. So some companies started basically advertising, hey, we're going to hire anesthesiologists. We're going to have them come in, and you have same day all on dentures, where you come in, we put you to sleep. And then you wake up and you have a full mouth of new teeth, and you didn't have to experience any of it. You had rotten teeth when you came in, and now you have a full mouth of dentures that are, you know, implanted on, and you leave. And people, for good reason, love that. You know, patients were very taken in by that. And ever since that model kind of was introduced, it's really exploded to where that's kind of what people want to do now, which has become a big market. And that's why a lot of dentists are asking for anesthesiologists to come in now to help them with these surgeries.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That sounds, I can see why it would be popular. I'm sure when you wake up, it's gotta be pretty painful, right? You've had your bone drilled. You've had all kinds of stuff. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about how you're doing the anesthesia. So you're doing anesthesia in the dental office. What are you doing? What are the different approaches?
Yeah. So, there's kind of two different approaches that people tend to take with anesthesia in the dental office. And it's really dependent on what procedure you're doing and the patient base that you're doing it on, and your comfort level with each approach. So basically it's going to be, are you going to do, you know, your typical, general endotracheal tube anesthetic, just like you would do at the hospital, or are you going to do an open airway? So there's advantages and disadvantages to both. So typically with endotracheal tube anesthesia, when you're thinking about doing it on a typical, like, let's say just pediatric dental cases, the advantages of that are going to be obvious, right? You want to protect the airway. They're doing dental work in the mouth. They're going to be drilling with water. There's going to be contamination. You don't want to be sharing that airway. You want to be able to protect that airway and make sure that nothing's getting down there. We're not having an aspiration or anything like that. You can use an inhalational agent that's got a lot of great advantages to it. And if you're doing kids, you can mask them down, and you don't have to do an IM ketamine or something to put them to sleep, which is obviously a great advantage. And a lot of parents really appreciate that as well. But you know, with all the advantages that you think you have, and you would just say, why don't we just do that? You know, there's some disadvantages to it as well. So some of the disadvantages is that, you know, you do have to bring a lot more equipment for that when you're coming into the office. But other than that, you're also, you know, you're doing airway management, you're doing airway manipulation. So you do tend to get a lot more of your reactive airway diseases, your bronchospasms, your laryngospasms, stuff like that, going to be a lot more likely to happen when you're instrumenting the airway versus, as opposed to not. You also are going to be introduced to more MH triggers. You're more likely to need to use succinylcholine, and you're going to be using inhalational agents. So you're really going to have to worry about introducing the risk of MH at the office if that happens, and you have to carry probably Ryanodex for that, you know, if you're going to be doing this in the dental office. One thing with dental work as well that not a lot of people think about typically with anesthesia, because you're usually doing an oral tube, I'm doing a nasal tube, so I'm really concerned about nosebleeds. Nosebleeds are one of my least favorite things to happen at the office. I do a lot to try to avoid them. You're introducing that risk as well. Whereas if you're doing an open airway anesthetic, you're kind of reducing the risk of that.
What do you do try to avoid nosebleeds, Connor?
Yeah, absolutely. I have actually been leaning a lot more towards using uncuffed endotracheal tubes now. It's crazy. The cuff really adds a lot of friction and a lot of shearing force to the nasal wall. As opposed to, you know, even if I'm using let's say a 4-5 cuff tube versus a 5-0 uncuffed tube, the 5-0 uncuffed tube is going to do less damage to that nose than the 4-5 cuff tube is. Even though it's for the same size child, right? In addition to that, I typically, will warm up my endotracheal tubes, to make them, more pliable, kind of floppy, to allow them to pass through the nasal pharynx and be flexible and kind of follow the passage better and not shear off some of the nasal mucosa as well. People use different things for that. You can use warmers, you can use warm saline, you know, a bunch of different things. Typically, if I'm concerned about a nosebleed, I might do Afrin in the nose prior to passing the tube. A lot of people really like red rubber catheters. That's something I don't typically do as often, but a lot of people really.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Financial stress affects far more than our bank accounts. It can take a serious toll on mental health and relationships. Money worries often bring anxiety, sleep disruption, and even depression, and are one of the leading sources of conflict for couples. It's important to remember that struggling with money doesn't mean you failed. Sometimes it's just about accessing the right kind of support. I've definitely felt overwhelmed at times, especially when I was a resident, trying to figure out how to stretch the dollars farther than they wanted to go. It can be so helpful at those times to get some therapy, not for financial advice, but to manage the stress, shame, or anxiety that can come with financial worries. With over 30,000 therapists who are fully licensed in the U.S., BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. And with 12 plus years of experience and an industry-leading match fulfillment rate, they typically get it right the first time. But if you aren't happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time. Your emotional well-being matters. When life feels overwhelming, therapy can help. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Hey, folks. Hunger strikes and you're exhausted. There's something healthy in your fridge that you should be making, but you just don't have it in you. Sound familiar? For me, eating healthy isn't a willpower problem. It's a setup problem until I found Factor. Factor solves the setup problem with fully prepared meals designed by dietitians and crafted by chefs delivered right to your door. My wife and I want to give our kids healthy food that they will actually eat, but we don't have time to cook from scratch. That's why we use Factor, and you should too. Inside your Factor box, you'll find lean proteins, colorful veggies, whole food ingredients, and healthy fats. It's always fresh, never frozen. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and honestly, they're right. Over 100 rotating weekly meals, including globally inspired flavors like Mediterranean and Asian, so there's always something new to look forward to. Try the newly launched ready-to-eat salads with vibrant ingredients like elote corn and miso edamame. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it, and now I can't get enough. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Head to factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off and free daily greens per box. With new subscription only while supplies last until 9/27/26. See website for more details.
Hey folks, this time of year always makes me rethink what's in my closet. I'm trying to keep fewer things, but better ones, pieces that are well made and easy to wear all the time. That's why I keep coming back to Quince. The fabrics feel elevated, the fits are thoughtful, and the pricing actually makes sense. Quince makes high-quality everyday essentials using premium materials like 100% European linen and their insanely soft flow-knit activewear fabric. Their men's linen pants and shirts are lightweight, breathable, and comfortable, basically the perfect layer for spring. And their flow-knit activewear, moisture-wicking, anti-odor, and soft enough that you'll actually want to wear it all day. The best part is that their prices are 50 or 60% less than similar brands. How? Because they work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. I absolutely love the zip-up fleece I got from Quince. I wear it all the time, and it might be the only thing my wife and daughters actually compliment me on. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. Go to quince.com/ACCRAC for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ACRAC.
Hey, folks. I wanted to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, FIGS scrubs. Made for us and humans, these are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my FIGS, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all FIGS all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, a medical student, CRNA, or CRNA student, or an anesthesiologist like me. Investing in a couple of pairs of FIGS is totally worth it. We're partnering with FIGS to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. FIGS goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try FIGS today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout. That's FIGSRX at checkout. All right, and we're back, and Connor's going to tell us how he uses the red rubber catheter to place a nasal tube.
Yeah, so what you do is you attach the red rubber catheter to the end of the nasal tube, and you actually pass that through the nose, down into through the nasal pharynx, into the oral pharynx. And then what you do is you open up the mouth and you look for the red rubber catheter back in the oropharynx, and you take a McGill forceps, you grab it, and you pull the tube through the nose that way. And then you unattach the red rubber catheter, and then you just intubate as you normally would.
And what's the advantage? Is that because the red rubber catheter kind of covers the sharp end of the tube?
Yep, exactly. And it's very flexible. And then honestly, a lot of the reason that you cause nasal trauma a lot of times when you're placing a nasal tube is the nasal – you know, the nasal cavity isn't always a straight shot down. It's sometimes it kind of weaves side to side. You kind of have to get past these little curves. And the rigid tube can really do some damage when you're trying to shove it past there. But the rubber catheter will follow the deviations more naturally. And then as you're pulling it through, the pulling action will pull the rigid part of the endotracheal tube past those deviations more naturally. And you won't get the trauma that you would otherwise.
Okay. So now when you do an uncuffed tube, how do you deal with a leak? Does the dentist pack the throat? Do you just use a big enough tube that there's not as big of a leak?
Yeah. So that's something that you definitely have to take into account for, because you will have leaks. The good thing about dentistry, having a shared airway, is that when dentists do, you know, when they start prepping to start working, they'll use a molt expander to open the mouth, a bite block to open the mouth. The chin will be tilted back because you'll do a shoulder roll, and then so you have the chin tilted back. You do the bite block, and then you pack the throat pack, and all of that works extremely well to not only close the pharynx around the tube and get rid of the leak, but also the throat pack also gets rid of the leak as well. Yeah. So typically once the dentist starts working, I don't have a leak anymore. So sometimes it's just like, okay, I have a leak. I need to ventilate this patient a little bit better. Let's go ahead and just do the bite block and put in the throat pack now, even though we might not need it for a couple minutes. That way I get rid of the leak.
Okay. So let's say you're doing open airway. You're not going to intubate. Are you running a propofol infusion? What are you doing usually?
Yeah. So, for open airway, the typically what people are going to be doing is a remifentanil and propofol infusion is very popular. When you're thinking about doing like pediatrics for that, since you can't do an inhalational induction, what a lot of people will do they will do either a nitrous IV or they'll do IM ketamine mixed with Versed and atropine. Versed just to help a little bit to reduce the amount of ketamine you need, and then the atropine to counteract the effects of, you know, the increased saliva production and all that kind of fun stuff from ketamine. So they'll do that, and then they'll start the IV, and they'll use maybe a little bit of Presidex, and then a Remiprop-Tiva is going to be the go-to method for that typically.
And why IM and not intranasal?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't do this method. I do intubated for all of my pediatrics, and I bring a machine with me, and I mask down everybody. So you absolutely could do intranasal Versed or something like that, and then do some nitrous, and that would be an excellent idea to do. Or intranasal Presidex as well is something you can do.
I think our peds folks are doing a lot more of that now.
Yeah, that would be great as well. Either way, you're not going to be able to do a mask down, so you have to have some sort of alternative method of getting these patients sedated enough that you can start an IV.
And then you're running.
Yep. Then you're going to be running your Remiprop. So there are some advantages to doing open airway. Typically, it's reserved for good candidates for open airway. So you don't want people who are going to be obstructive. Obviously, you need to have a well trained dentist who's very good at controlling the water and the contamination of anything that could get back to the airway. You're putting a lot of trust into the operator's hands to make sure that you're not contaminating the airway and getting an aspiration or anything like that. Dentists have these awesome things called isolites. It's essentially a bite block that has a big rubber curtain that goes along the back of the throat, completely covers the back of the throat, and it has a suction on that curtain that sucks water as it's going back, and it keeps everything really dry back there. So I know a lot of people that do open airway for their cases. They like to use isolites. They like to have their dentists use isolites. Advantages of doing this: you have to bring less equipment to the office. You're avoiding MH triggers. There's less manipulation of the airway. Also, one of the advantages, and when I do open airways, say for adults or something, one thing that I always try to do with my open airway, and when you're running Remiprop specifically for your Tiva, you can get one, if you use really good local and you have your dentist give really good local, you can get these people pretty light and still be asleep. You can have your Remiprop running for a kid, you can have it running at 50, you know, for an adult, you can have it running at 20 or 25, and they'll still be asleep. Because they're numb and you're doing some fillings and they're not going to feel it. And you can have those people awake really fast, really, really fast. I know some of my colleagues who are doing pediatrics, open airways, they can discharge patients pretty quick, and their kids are awake in 5 minutes. So you're a lot closer to your safe space if something were to happen. You know, you can wake up somebody pretty quickly. And then your disadvantages of that is everything we just talked about. So soiling of the airway, your airway's unprotected. You can have laryngospasm if something does get back there, stuff like that. So obvious disadvantages of that. And you're putting a lot of trust into the dentist as well.
All right. Let's talk about what you bring with you. So, you know, this is not something a lot of anesthesiologists are familiar with, where you're kind of taking all your equipment with you. So what do you bring?
Yeah. So this is a dental office. So basically anything that you might need, you have to bring, right? Pretty much the only thing the dental office is going to have for you is going to be the suction. So when you're looking at portable anesthesia machines, there's a lot of different models. You can find them online. You can Google them. Essentially what it's going to be is it's going to be, the anesthetic machine minus the ventilator, and portion of it, and then minus the big undercarriage. So, it'll have, you know, oxygen, nitrous, sevoflurane, or isoflurane if you choose. And then the circle system attached to it. And that's pretty much it. That's one thing that I typically bring. And if you're going to be doing intubated general anesthetics, you're going to have that. you're going to have to remember you don't have a ventilator. So that means no PSV Pro. That means no putting them on pressure control or volume control if you need your hands for something else. If they're apneic, then you're sitting there bagging. So that's something that you definitely have to keep in mind. There are some offices, I actually, you know, one of my busier offices, I actually bought a full ventilator that I keep there. So you can do that. It's going to be a little more, you know, if you're going to buy a ventilator for every single office, that's going to have some costs associated with it. But it's really nice to have and keep it at the office. I come in, I plug it in just like I would at the hospital. So you can certainly do that. But most people tend to go the portable anesthetic machine route. Now, one thing you have to think about is, right, if you're going to be hooking up oxygen and nitrous, where are you going to be getting that from? So most dental offices, especially like pediatric offices, are going to have they're going to have oxygen and nitrous piped because they're using nitrous a lot of times for their kids. There's a lot of the offices around me, and this could be regional specific, have Accutron hookups. And you can actually buy an Accutron adapter that it goes into their emergency oxygen bypass, and it has a DISS adapter for it to where I can hook up my oxygen tubing and run it directly into my machine. And now instead of me having to bring in E-tanks, now I'm hooked into their H-tank, which has a lot more oxygen. You know? So I have 7,000 liters of oxygen in one of their H-tanks now, right? So that's one less worry to have versus, you know, bringing in a bunch of E-tanks of oxygen. Typically, most of the offices I work at don't have nitrous bypasses like that. So I do have to bring in my nitrous E-tanks to run off of. But you get a lot more nitrous. The nitrous goes a lot farther than an oxygen tank does when you're running an E-tank of oxygen. Plus, I have no qualms with disconnecting a nitrous tank to replace it in the middle of a case, but I really don't want to be disconnecting an oxygen tank to replace it in the middle of the case. So obviously, you should always prefer to hook up to the wall oxygen if you can. As far as wasting your anesthetic gas from the machine, that's something else you have to think about because they're not going to have a WAGD in the wall that you just plug it into, right? Like you would at the hospital. So what you can do is a lot of these offices that have nitrous, they'll have scavenger lines for the nitrous that they have to have for their nitrous as well. And you can disconnect it and then you can connect your tubing from your WAGD from your portable machine straight up to their nitrous scavenger. And then that works very, very well. You can also take one of their suctions and take a surgical suction and cut it and use their normal suction and hook that up to your machine and use that because that suction vents out to the environment just like it would at the hospital. So that's another way to get it out of the OR because you don't want those gases accumulating, obviously, and that would be a violation of OSHA standards and HIP and EPA standards, whatever those are. So that's one thing you have to think about bringing to the office and the portable anesthetic machine. And then as far as the suction goes, that's available in offices, they will have two different suctions available to you. They will have a high volume, suction that is typically, if you go into a dental office, it's the real thick suction. It's going to be 11 millimeters or around a half inch internal diameter, which is bigger than the non-conductive tubing that we typically use for yank hours, which is around a quarter inch diameter. So it's a bigger suction. It's really rigid, so it's not really good to use in the back of the throat or anything like that. And it's really powerful. So you don't want to be getting the uvula in it or anything. So typically I don't use that, but I can hook up non-conductive tubing to it if I want to use my yank hour. So that's typically what I would use that for is just as something to hook up my yank hour to through non-conductive tubing. And then they'll have a saliva ejector. So the saliva ejector is the little Mr. Thirsty straw that you can bend and everything. And that works fantastic for suctioning around the tube prior to extubation or, you know, just if you need to clear out the airway a little bit, cause you can bend it however you want, and get it right down along that tongue all the way down into the vocula and all the way down near the vocal cords. So those are pretty great. The only problem with those is that they tend to get clogged fairly easily, which is one thing you do have to keep in mind if you have a bloody if you have blood in the airway or blood in the oral cavity that you're trying to suction out. So that is one thing to think about. other than that, you know, there's always special considerations. So if you do want to have staff with you, you have to bring that as well. So dental offices won't have nurses or anything like that for PACU coverage. So that's something you have to bring. And then some special considerations I have for dental offices as opposed to the hospital is, like I mentioned before, you're going to probably want Ryanodex if you're thinking about MH. You're not going to have enough help to mix up Dantrolene. So I would highly encourage.
Connor, just so I want to make sure everybody knows, yeah. Ryanodex is the newer, very concentrated form of Dantrolene so that you don't have to sit there mixing up a million vials, which is what you used to have to do in the old formulation. So you're saying having the newer formulation, Ryanodex, allows you to, you know, as one person and not having a whole bunch of people coming to help, you can very quickly get the amount you need if you think you're facing MH.
Yes, absolutely. And so, I think the recommendations are 36 vials of Dantrolene and 3 vials of Ryanodex. So a lot less to reconstitute. In addition to that, think about, you know, because you're going to be working with the dental staff and you don't have so many hands during an emergency, what kind of emergency supplies do you want to have that are going to be easily accessible and usable by dental staff? So, you know, I have a manual defibrillator, a life pack, but I also have a automatic AED just in case, you know, my hands are tied and we need to use it. Something that the dental staff can very easily use. And then if you want anything specific for emergencies as well, you know, things that are going to be easy to use in emergency situations for you, because, you're going to be doing a lot of different things at once. So things like, you know, instead of a traditional, Krike kit in case of an emergency surgical airway, maybe you want to do one of the quick trakes or something like that. So things like that are all the types of things that you think about going to a dental office versus like an ambulatory surgery center or the hospital.
Great. Let's hit some of the kind of highlights of what you think is important for people to think about when they're preparing or pre-opping for their day in the dental office.
Yeah. So the big difference is that, you know, when I was in the hospital, it was really easy to get medical records. We had, even if they hadn't been to our hospital before, there's the shared records tab in the EMR that you could find their other hospital records as well. And it was pretty easy to put together a pretty good clinical picture of what's going on with a patient before even talking to them. You just have no access to that, you know, when you're not associated with a hospital or an ambulatory surgery center and you're relying purely on the patients, or, you know, you need to send them to go get physicals so that their primary care provider can give you an accurate summary of their medical record. So when you're pre-opping, you know, there's a huge need for good medical histories. I do send all of my kids for H's and P's, just so that I know I'm not missing anything, because parents and patients can be pretty unreliable at times. They can miss things. They forget to mention things, and you don't want to miss anything. You're going to want a recent and accurate height and weight, because that's a big thing as well. Especially, you know, because you don't want to be doing too high of a BMI if it's only you at the office and you don't have a second set of hands to mask the patient while you're getting the IV or whatever. Additionally on that, you know, it's just good to have a second set of eyes and ears on a patient, catching things like heart murmurs or things that might need optimized prior to the day of surgery. If a primary care physician catches it in the office 3 weeks before I'm supposed to see him, maybe it's something that we can get worked up and maybe something that we can get taken care of before the day of surgery instead of catching it the day of surgery and having to reschedule. And then, you know, when I think about selecting patients for the office while I'm pre-opping and who I'm going to cancel and who I'm going to reschedule, who I'm going to send to a hospital, patient selection is so critical in the dental office. Because you just don't have any help. And it's just you there, and everyone has a bar for what they're comfortable with, right? But what you don't want to do is you never want to be moving that bar steadily up, right? So whatever you set that bar with for whatever you're comfortable with, it's really easy to say, hey, you know, I did this kid with a big BMI last week and it went fine. So I can do the kid. They were 98th percentile. I can do this 99th percentile BMI or weight percentile. That's totally fine. Or, hey, I did this, you know, mild systemic disease last week. And so this moderate one should be fine, right? One of the books I'm going to mention later, actually, it's about The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And what they talk about with Great Lake Shipping is that when it comes to storms and stuff, a lot of the sailors always used to say, you know, they weren't worried about the storm during the storm, because I've been in a storm before. I haven't died yet. We haven't had any issues yet. So why would I die now? Right. Why would we sink now? But it's a binary event, right? Either you sink or you don't. Either you have a big issue in the dental office or you don't. And the way they describe it in the book is, you know, it's like walking blindfolded at the Grand Canyon, right? You never really know how close to the edge you are. You're walking blindfolded and you take your blindfold off and you didn't fall down the Grand Canyon. So guess what? You're safe the entire time. Well, you could have been right close to the edge and you didn't know it. And at the hospital, that's one thing. And obviously this applies to everybody in anesthesia, not just at the dental office, right? But at the dental office, it's huge. It's everything, because you can't have emergencies. You have to bat 1,000, right? So you don't want to walk blindfolded. You need to have a bar and you need to stick with it. And when you're pre-oping your patients, you know, you have to have set things. Like, you tell the dental office, hey, if they're this, like, don't even send them to me. Just send them to the hospital. Like, if they're over this BMI, if they're over this weight percentile, like, these are an automatic no. And you stick with it. You have to stick with it. And then when I pre-op patients, I do a pre-op phone call for everybody. And I'll talk to, like, parents beforehand and patients. I'll let them know what to expect. Because a lot of times, especially for parents, because at the hospital for pediatrics, a lot of times parents aren't allowed to go back, right? So at the dental office, cause you know, at the hospital, they're big ORs and you're far away from them and they can't hear anything that's going on. Well, in the dental office, if you bring that back their kid and they hear them screaming for like 3 minutes as you're trying to mask them down, they're not going to like that. You know, they're not going to appreciate that. And it's nice for the kids, you know, for them to be able to have their parents. So I'll do a pretty extensive conversation with the parents beforehand, like, hey, this is what to expect, right? You're going to be back there. I might need you to help, you know, kind of hold their hands or kind of talk them through it. So I need to make sure that the parents are prepared for that. I'm not doing oral Versed as well at the office, because I don't want kids, I don't want to have to wait, and I don't want to have unsupervised kids with on oral Versed in the waiting room. So the kids are more likely to wig out a little bit than they might be at a hospital. The one thing I do have is a TV, and that is probably better than the oral Versed, to be honest with you. I don't want my kids watching too much TV at the dental office. Throw it on. Let's put on some Bluey. Come on, come back here and do some nice. This kid will be just fine. So I just talk parents through that and make sure that they're prepared for everything with that.
Great. And then you mentioned bringing someone with you to manage the PACU. So you bring a nurse with you and then, or someone with you to manage patients afterwards, as in the quote unquote PACU. How does that work?
Yeah. So, I do bring a nurse or actually an EMT or a paramedic with me, when I go and do kids. Typically I won't for adults. For adults, typically I'm just doing mostly like one or two cases, or I'm doing them in an oral surgery office where they have nurses and staff and stuff. So I don't need to worry about a mask down, right? And somebody holding the mask while I get the IV. But when I do kids, I do bring somebody for PACU, and I don't recover my own patients. So when it comes to approaching PACU and approaching wake-ups, I think more important than anything, it's not necessarily speed of wake-ups, right? It's consistency. Because what you want is you want them to be, it doesn't matter if they're 20-minute wake-ups, if they're 45-minute wake-ups, if you want to use Precedex or not, if you want to push that wake-up longer, but they wake up nicer, that's totally fine. But the dental office needs to know that so that you're not backing up. So, you know, everyone knows what to expect, because you don't want parents sitting there saying, hey, when's my kid going to wake up? You said it was going to be 20 minutes. Now it's 45 and they're still not awake. That's going to freak them out. Right. So more than anything, it's just consistency. I do avoid Precedex, and I do default to fast acting narcotics. So I use fentanyl at the beginning of the case, and I typically don't. I might redose like 5 mics to a kid halfway through if it's a longer case, but otherwise I'm not redosing it because it is dental work and kids are getting numbed up for extraction, stuff like that. And they might wake up a little bit uncomfortable, but it's done awake and they can have it done awake. So they don't necessarily need a lot of narcotics on wake up. And when you're doing PACU at the dental office, you don't want to be holding people there all day, right? It's a lot like an ambulatory surgery center. I mean, people who work at ambulatory surgery centers are going to know a lot about this and have the same issue where you're just trying to get people awake and safe as soon as possible. So, when you're discharging, you know, you do have to make sure that your patients aren't snowed. And if you do have to hold somebody for longer, you have to have a plan for that, right? So typically my wake up room is going to be the room right next to the room we're using as the operatory. I'll have the nurse sit in there and monitor the patient, fully monitored while I'm turning over, talking to the next patients, that kind of fun stuff. But if I need to start the next case and this patient, you know, they might be awake, but they're just not quite there yet. And the parents are a little bit uncomfortable and they, you know, they want to stick around. You know, you kind of got to think about what are you going to do? Cause you don't want to have them right there while you're starting the next case and you have another screaming kid and you're trying to manage two things at once. So you need to either have another room where, and you can have another staff member kind of stay in there with them and make sure that the kid's awake and not, you know, not falling back into sedation or anything like that. But you just have to have a plan for that. And you need to have a plan for patients that you're not quite ready to discharge, but you do think that they're awake enough that you can probably start the next case. You just need to have a plan for that.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about emergencies. I mean, this scares me, right? For me, where I work, if I have an emergency in the OR, I've got 30 people who will come in about 2 seconds and help me. Right. But when you are there, it's just you, maybe you have a nurse or an EMT or a paramedic with you, but you know, what do you do, to try to optimize avoidance of emergencies and how do you deal with them when they happen?
Yeah. So, you know, and this is the part, where I do want to bring up and I do want to talk about the fact that there have been some high profile incidents, at dental offices and recently, and they've been covered quite extensively by the news and people have been rightfully angry about them. I'm going to try to choose my words very, very carefully and slowly here. And try to approach this with as much tact as I possibly can, because quite frankly, it's a tragedy, right? And anytime there is a bad outcome at the dental office, a lot of times you hear about it where things, you know, weren't done appropriately and not handled the best. And there's just no getting around it that it doesn't matter who it is. I'm going to use, you know, I'm going to say we as in everybody, you know, not just us, not dentists, anesthesiologists, not oral surgeons or moderate sedation dentists or physicians working in dental offices or CRNAs working in dental offices. It's everybody. It's not a single group of people thing. You know, everybody has had these incidents and it's something that quite frankly, we do need to do better at, and we need to do a better job of preventing this from happening in the future. Cause preventable deaths are just, or bad outcomes are just, it's something that should never happen, right? They're never events, right? You never want to have something where it's like, well, if this wasn't done at a dental office, this patient would not have had this bad outcome. That those are unacceptable. And you know, I don't speak for anybody and I can't speak for any other groups or anything like that. I don't speak for any of our organizations or anything. We are approaching that from our American Society of Dentists and Anesthesiologists recently came out with a 5-year plan. That they have to do their strategic plan. And a big part of that is approaching patient safety and preventing these types of things from happening. And part of that is just making sure that we're being held responsible and everyone's holding each other responsible for making sure that these things don't happen in the dental office. Now with that being said, one thing that I did want to ask listeners as well, is, you know, I've already, you know, these things are unacceptable, but we do anesthesia, like we practice anesthesiology. Everybody knows things happen and there is no such thing as 100% safe anesthetic, no matter where it's done, no matter what strategies you take to try to prevent things from happening. Sometimes things happen. And things do happen in the dental offices that would have happened at the hospital. And one thing I do tell, you know, I tell residents I work with all the time when it comes to selecting patients and why patient selection is so important for the dental office is, like I said, you have to bat 1,000. You can't have any issues come up. You can't send people to the hospital ever. Because I could take the same anesthetic, the same patient, a healthy patient. I could have an emergency happen. I could do everything exactly the same. I could do the same management. I could have everything be the same on the same patient and have the same outcome. And it's a bad outcome. And in the hospital, you know, it's one thing. In a dental office, you're going to get murdered for it, just raked over the coals, even though you did everything exactly right and exactly the same. I'm going to stay away from specific cases, but there have been cases recently where it's a freak accident, right? And no, it wouldn't have been caught if it was in the hospital or an ambulatory surgery center either. But because it was done in a dental office, you know, it's the person's, you know, crucified for it. And one thing I would ask people is that we don't rush to judgment. You know, one thing that physicians do so well is talk about the second victim, right? And when there's a bad outcome, how much that can affect the provider. And one thing I would ask is just that, you know, there's a time to be rightfully angry about things that are done in the dental office. And when details do come out and it's time to be angry, yeah, let's be angry, but let's not rush to judgment. Let everything come out before just jumping on somebody when something does happen.
Yeah, that's so important.
Yeah. So thank you for letting me say that. But you know, now that we've acknowledged that bad things have been happening in dental offices and we have to do better. So what do you do when it is time, you know, when there is an emergency in the dental office, what can you expect from dental staff? Cause like you said, you know, it's just you, and maybe the EMT or the nurse that you brought with you and then the dental staff. Like I said, this is why patient selection is so important, because you have to bat 1,000 and it's all about safety and making sure that you're not picking cases where things like this can happen. But when something does happen, typically what you can expect is that, you know, the dentists and their staff are typically just going to be BLS certified. So as we all know, there's 6 roles in an emergency situation in ACLS. So the pit crew model is that you're going to have somebody for airway, you're going to have a team leader, you're going to have somebody on IV, you're going to have somebody on the AED, somebody doing chest compressions, and somebody doing recording, right? And activating emergency services. So you're pretty much going to have to be airway, IV, and team leader all at once, or your nurse or paramedic could be IV. But it's largely going to fall on the dental office to do BLS and to operate the AED and to activate emergency services. So you want to make sure that your staff, the dental staff, is comfortable that they're all BLS certified, that they're taking it seriously when they're doing it. You want to make sure that they have an established plan in place for, you know, hey, where's EMS? What doors are they going to come into? Where are we putting the parents or the care or the driver or the caregiver? When EMS comes here, when are we notifying them? How are we going to tell them? You know, are we going to put them in a separate room so that they're not just seeing EMS walk in and they're like, what is going on here? How did this, you know, what's going on? Is there an emergency? I wasn't told, you know? And then early activation of EMS is so, so critical out in the dental office, because you just don't have the hands. Sometimes you just need hands and you need somebody to help you get a second IV and to start infusions and to help handle the airway and things like that. And so I would always rather be the provider who cried wolf and called EMS and had to tell them, hey, actually, we don't need you. Everything turned out fine. I'd rather be embarrassed and do that than be the guy who didn't call 911. And that's something, you know, and that's not just a dental office thing. You know, surgery centers have gotten some flack for that recently too, where they didn't activate EMS quickly enough, you know, and you never want that to be the case. So it's easier to explain why you activated too early than it is to explain why you didn't activate when you should have. So that, I mean, that's kind of how you have to approach it when there is an emergency in the dental office. You need to get them to a hospital. You need to get them somewhere where they can get definitive care. And in the meantime, you do the best you can. And you just know that you're going to be doing most of the advanced stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's super important. So if you had to end with some key advice, Connor, how would you sum it all up?
Yeah, absolutely. So any advice I'd have for anybody that's exploring, you know, this space or starting this within this space, the first thing you have to do is just emphasize safety early and often. I mean, like I said, safety is everything. Good patient selection. Make sure you have all the equipment you could possibly need. Redundancies on redundancies on redundancies. So many things that you might not possibly ever need. You might buy them and waste the money on them. Just have them, right? And then when you're talking to offices, emphasize safety when you're selling. So when I first started, you know, I went out and I cold called offices and I went out and I just talked to them. And when I was selling myself to them, when I was saying, you know, you could approach it from 2 ways. You can say, hey, we're going to do so many cases. We're going to make so much money. We're going to produce so much, but that's going to be the expectation. And when you cancel cases on them and you say, hey, this kid's sick, we're not going to do them today. I'm sorry, but they have a cough. They have a productive cough. and you're going to get the backlash of, well, you've been canceling cases on me so often, you know, we're not producing, we need to produce all this fun stuff. If you go out there and you say, hey, the number one priority, it's a mission statement, right? It's a vision statement. We're going to be safe. That's what we're doing. We're safe. That's what we're going to be known for. That's what we're going to do. That's going to drive every decision, right? Every decision comes back. Is this safe or is this not safe? So I'm going to be comfortable, you know, canceling things. I might be a kind of a wimp sometimes about it, but is it safe or is it not? And I've never, that's how I sold it when I was first starting. I've never had any pushback on canceling cases because it wasn't safe or saying, hey, this is a hospital case. This is not a case here. Because that's how I sold it. And I made sure everyone was very aware. And now, you know, people are very comfortable with that. And my offices don't give me stuff that's not safe. They know that when I'm going to say no. In that sense, you have to know when to say no, right? You have to stick to your guns. You can't let yourself be persuaded because people are going to try to persuade you to do things that you shouldn't do. Hey, this is going to be such a fast case. This is going to be so easy. You know, they should be fine if you just do this, right? Like, in all we have to do is one extraction. Who cares if they have a little bit of a cough? Just put them to sleep and we'll pull it and then they'll be done. Well, no, you have to have a line in the sand and you have to stick to it because it's important, right? And then my last piece of advice is I'm an Ohio State guy. I went to Ohio State for undergrad, for dental school, and for residency. So I was there for 11 years. And I grew up an Ohio State fan. So Woody Hayes is like my guy. But he had a quote, you win with people. It's something he always said. So if you surround yourself with people that you know and you trust and you treat them well and you give them some leeway and you give them the same grace that you'd want, you know, people have your back. And I work with some fantastic nurses. You know, I have ICU nurses. I have a NICU nurse that works with me. I have a paramedic that works with me. I have awesome people that I treat really well. I pay them for the day. If we have one case, you know, you're getting paid the whole full day. I bend over backwards for them to try to make sure that we can accommodate them. And I've had people travel for me, you know, really far. I've had people cancel their normal work days because they're all working for me part-time. They have normal jobs as well. And I've had people, you know, reschedule their work days to help me because I needed them. And as far as the dental offices go, you know, I give them a lot of grace. I've had some people have some issues where we had to cancel days from their perspective. Hey, no big deal. You know, it's fine. It happens. Life happens. That's fine. And then, you know, I blew a tire the other day on the way to work and say, hey, I blew a tire. I can't come anymore. That's fine. And they say, that's fine. You know, that's okay, Connor. It happens. You know, if you treat people how you want to be treated and then they'll treat you the same way and people will take care of you if you take care of other people. So I would say surround yourself with people that you want to be around and that you trust and treat them well.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. All right, let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Connor, what would you recommend people check out for fun?
Yeah, awesome. So like I was telling you before, Jed, I am a dad. I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, which means that I do not have access to my TV. It is not my TV anymore. So I know nothing about TV shows or movies. I don't go to movies anymore. So I don't have any good recommendations for that. But I did. So when I'm sitting there and I'm watching Lion King for the millionth time, right? I have to have something to do because I can only watch so much Lion King before it's like, okay. And I gave up. Actually, I'm a practicing Catholic. I gave up social media for Lent. So that's great. I don't get to watch movies or TVs and I can't look at social media. What am I going to do? So I've actually been reading more. I read a book that I mentioned before. It's called The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. It's by John Hugh Bacon. And I'm not sure, are you familiar with the Edmund Fitzgerald story?
No.
There's a famous song, if you looked it up, by Gordon Lightfoot, called The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And it's about this boat, this Great Lakes freighter that, if you heard the song, you would know it. And it's about the boat sinking in Lake Superior in 1975. And the book explores the wreck, of the freighter. And, it's a very famous wreck. And it not only talks about that, but it talks about just like Great Lakes shipping as a whole. And it's fascinating to me. I like history and I like the Great Lakes. I'm from Ohio. So it's fascinating for me from that standpoint, but also it's a lot like the airline industry, right? How we talk about there's so many similarities between the airline industry and us. Same thing with the shipping industry, apparently. I didn't know until I read the book. There's a lot of phrases in it, like, 99% boredom and 1% sheer terror when there's a storm. Man, that's relatable. There's a quote about the captain being, you don't pay the captain for the normal days, you pay him for what they do on the rough seas. Man, that's relatable. So it's a great book. Yeah, I encourage that. And then another book, sorry, I have a couple here. Another book that it's actually a short essay that that I really liked. It's Self-Reliance by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I would highly encourage, especially anybody who's, a CA3 about to be graduating here pretty soon or a new attending, to read. It's a lot about, trusting yourself and trusting your instincts and not always going with the grain. There's a lot of self-doubt that a lot of people have when they first start out, a lot of imposter syndrome. But you guys are well-trained, and you've been doing this for, training for a long time to prepare for this and you deserve to be here and you deserve to have opinions. And when you first become an attending, it's kind of weird. It's sticker shock, hey, people are listening to me now and people are really interested in what I have to say about things. And I actually have to make decisions and who am I to make these decisions? Right. I was just in residency a couple months ago, but your opinion does matter and you do have good instincts and you do know what you're talking about. So, you can trust yourself and this essay, it's kind of a difficult read, but if you can get through it, it's pretty short. It does a good job of explaining to do that. And then finally, the last recommendation I have, sorry, I know we're going a little long here, is, I'm a big coffee person. Me and my wife, whenever we're somewhere, we like to get the local coffee. And St. Frank Coffee out of San Francisco, is fantastic. And you can buy it online. St. Frank. So, Saint, and then, F-A-R-A-N-K. Okay. But it's great. I encourage anybody to try it. It's really good. Anybody who likes coffee, I encourage you to try it.
Nice. Well, those are some great recommendations. I'm going to recommend a TV show that, is warning. It is both very violent and very sexually graphic, but it's very entertaining. And so if you don't mind those first two things, it's a great show just for entertainment. It's called Banshee, B-A-N-S-H-E-E. It's an HBO show. Definitely gets really highly rated if you look at Rotten Tomatoes and it's very entertaining. So if you don't mind, the violence, check it out.
Yeah, that's the one. Isn't the guy from Anthony Starr, isn't he in that one? That's what I thought. Yeah, I've heard good things about
Highlander
that.
On The Boys.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Connor, this has been fabulous. Great material. Thanks so much for taking the time to come on the show.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jed. I appreciate it.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook, we are on Reddit, and we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.